Let's go ahead and begin. We want to leave a lot of time for your questions this afternoon, so we'll get started. My name is Nathan Bierma. I'm Communications and Research Coordinator at the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship, and I'm a freelance journalist, so I am doubly interested in Richard's work. Richard Osling is a longtime religion correspondent for Time magazine, nearly 30 years, I believe, over 20 cover stories that he wrote for Time. He also, before that, he worked for Christianity Today, and after that, he wrote for the Associated Press, from which he retired last year. He and his wife, Joan, are the author of the book Mormons in America, Mormonism in America.
Mormon America.
Which is arguably the best introduction to Mormonism in America, and just completed a revised edition of that, which is very timely with the Romney candidacy now in the news. In 2006, he won a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Religion News Writers Association, and he's won numerous awards for his religion reporting. And so I have a few questions that I want to get started, and then I definitely want to turn it over to you and let all of you ask your questions. I know you've said that you haven't covered worship per se very specifically, but you did have sort of a national perch to watch the America's religious landscape during the 90s. When the phrase worship wars really came to a fore. From that national perch, what did you see, and have the worship wars, as they're called, died down now?
Yeah, things seem to be a little calmer, but I think the issues are still there. You know, what do we do with worship? How much do we blend? You know, do we bring in more of this or more of that? A lot of churches, I think, are more varied, certainly, in the music styles that they use in worship as a result of the events of the last quarter century or more. And probably a lot of creative thinking, certainly new music has come out, but also a lot of creative thinking is going into worship, as we've learned here in the last 2 days. So things do seem calmer, but I mean that issue is, I think, always going to be before the church, and there are many more options than there were not so many decades ago, and so everybody's going to have to make choices and decisions, and you're going to have people in your congregation that are not happy with the choices that you make, and any way you go, in the sense you can't please everybody today, and there probably was a time in the past where you could, because everybody sort of did the same thing, and you know, in fact, I just thought of something. What year was that? Sometime in the 90s, I was in a car in Texas driving with two producers from public television. We were doing a television project. I was raised in the American Baptist Convention, and the male producer was Episcopalian. And the woman was a Pentecostalist in her background. So, I mean, think of the spread. That's kind of the spread of Protestantism in this country. And we were kind of, you know, tired and silly. And so we began singing campfire songs from church, you know, hymns and choruses and this kind of thing. Every one of us knew all the same stuff, you know, from Episcopal to Baptist to Pentecostal. We all sang the same stuff in our age group. We were, you know, folks in our 40s and 50s, you know, and it was all the same same kind of a thing. That doesn't pertain anymore. I do think, you know, the idea that contemporary music is sort of the ticket, you know, we have these mega churches, people flocking in, so if you have a worship band up front and a drummer and so on, this is going to pack them in, isn't necessarily true. I mean, a lot of churches have thrived that haven't gone in that direction. And I'm thinking of the Black Church. I was thinking of that this very morning with Professor Addington at the keyboard, and thinking about Black churches that I've been in, quite traditional. There are some, like, mega church contemporary Christian music gigs in the Black Church, but generally the more thriving churches are pretty traditional in their worship style. Now, that style is not white, Christian, Reformed, or Episcopalian. It's a distinctive style, and it has its element of informality, so on. But it is a very long tradition, to say the least. So I think if you totally lose tradition in a Christian worship context, you are losing a lot.
And you pointed out in your address, at least when I heard it yesterday morning, you held up the cover story from U.S. News and World Report, one of the other news weeklies, not as good as Time, that talked about a return to ritual, a return to tradition. And are we actually seeing a backlash against what's been seen as the baby boomers and the triumph of modern megachurch-style worship? Is the up-and-coming generation sort of reacting to that now?
Yeah, there are some stars in the wind that younger Americans like a little more or a lot more tradition in worship than the baby boomers did. And the best evidence of that I've seen, the U.S. News story was quite interesting, but it was anecdotal, which you can always do this in journalism, you know, find 10 people who invent a trend out of it. Yeah, anecdotal stuff, you can prove almost anything. Though I think they did catch a mood and a sense of something that's stirring out there in that article. But on a more empirical scientific basis, Robert Wiffenau has a book called After the Baby Boomers, which would probably be of interest to almost any pastor who's here this afternoon. He believes the church is facing nothing short of a crisis in reaching Americans in their 20s and 30s. A lot of talk about, the youth, where you usually think of high school or kids or, you know, the Sunday school and everything else. But that period after high school graduation and until you're settled in a career is much longer, more turbulent, more difficult for younger Americans than it used to be the case. So they've also become more secularized, I think more religiously uprooted. Now, what was fascinating to me is he asked this question, do you want contemporary and experimental new music in your congregation? You know, what is your preference for music? And in no age bracket was the answering yes, they might want more contemporary Christian music, 22% was the highest. So even with baby boomers, you're talking, 78% were more traditional. The lowest number, the most conservative answer, was Americans in their 20s, not Americans age 65 and above or in their 50s or whatever. 12% said yes in that survey that he did among people in their 20s. So this is the first really solid sign that I've seen that there is a move back toward tradition, which might mean more what we call blended worship than what would have been true 50 years ago. But more of a sense of, you know, let's look at heritage, let's look at roots. And I think the reason, if that is true, is everything else for young Americans is getting uprooted. You know, everything's turbulent and confused. Values, the economic situation, careers. Many more of them coming from parents who've divorced and all the difficulties that visits on children and on. So in an age of confusion and lack of roots, the church can provide that, as well as a sense of community, which is another big theme among people in their 20s.
And yet, as you pointed out, we're still in a period of great fluidity, even when it comes just to denominational loyalty. Is it true that just in the past 50 years or so, we've seen a huge increase in people switching from the denomination in which they were raised? You used the term switcher yesterday. Mm-hmm. What's a switcher, and what does that mean for churches around the country?
Yeah, switcher, you have a total free market in religion today. So a switcher is somebody who switches out of denomination or congregation A and switches into congregation B. What you want to do is avoid having people go into nothingness, which you can also. You can switch out of church involvement and just, you know, you could care less and you just drop church altogether. So that's also a danger with younger Americans as well. But yeah, there was a time where, let's say Lutherans tended to go be raised in Lutheran churches, and they tended to remain Lutherans through their life. They tended to marry other Lutherans, which helped reinforce that. That's certainly no longer the case. Christian Reformed, you see similar phenomena. Catholics, a lot of Catholics switch because of the higher divorce rate. you know, Catholics who cannot receive, are not supposed to receive communion if they're divorced and remarried. Naturally, if they wish to live the Christian life, will migrate to Protestant churches that have a more liberal view on that issue. So the rising divorce rate among Catholics has affected a lot of switching. And I suppose worship style, you know. If you really like a worship band, you're going to leave a very traditional church and go to a mega church that has that type of a thing. Or, you know, like Saturday night worship, you know, which a lot of churches do today. And Sunday morning, you can't get out of bed so easily. So all kinds of things going on. But, yeah, it's a total free market. Now, one thing this does is produce vital churches, because it means people tend to be there because they want to be there. They weren't forced to go, or they didn't, oh, I've got to go because Grandma went here, or my mother and dad expect me to show up this morning, that kind of a thing. The congregations really in the United States, for good or ill, really are a voluntary group. You know, the government's not forcing you. Certainly the culture is not forcing you to go to worship, and less your family is.
Do you foresee any decline, though, in switching, as you talked about the younger generation starved for stability and rootedness? Might that lead to longer-term commitments?
I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I just would say we're in a very fluid time religiously in this country. A lot of changes, not only in worship, and we have, you know, schisms coming and splits and divisions, and it's just a very unpredictable period. Also in the economy and in politics, so it's naturally religion reflects the same.
Was it ever personally frustrating for you when you were at time, especially in the 90s or the late 80s, when there were so many controversial stories about religion and so much religion news seems to be focused on conflict and scandal? Was it ever a source of embarrassment to you as a believer to be dealing with material that reflected so badly on the church?
Not exactly. No, I wouldn't say that. But it makes the job less pleasant. And it does wear you down. In fact, I think I was telling you, Nathan, that two of the best major newspaper religion writers in the country quit the religion beat altogether. Because of the Catholic child molesting scandals. And there are two aspects of that. One is it was totally dispiriting for people who are, you know, sensitive, and in one of the two cases, a devout churchgoer. But for both of them, it just was unhappy, unpleasant, just a topic that wears you down. You don't want to just write about. And then the other thing is it's boring. It's the same story every day. You're just changing the proper nouns. You know, it's the same sad story over and over again. Okay, then on top of that, we had 9/11, and then we had one of the world's great religions associated in the public mind with murder and suicide and slaughtering of innocent women and children, namely radical Islam. I mean, that's no joy to write about when you think about it either. You know. And then, on top of that, then we got hit with the schism over sexual morality, biblical authority, and the gay issue in just about every mainline Protestant church in North America. And again, that is, it's a difficult issue, it's enervating, and it is ridden with conflict. And the longer it goes, the nastier it gets, particularly right now in the Episcopal Church. And it's a very nasty situation.
We'll keep going for about 10 or 15 minutes and then open it up to all your questions. Is that all right? Okay, great. Thanks. To follow up on that, can you talk about how editors and colleagues responded to the fact that you were a churchgoer, were a Christian? Did you feel like you were in an environment of hostility toward that, or what was that like?
That's interesting. Probably not, actually. They could care less.
Okay.
I mean, if you weren't a churchgoer, they could care less. They really, that didn't interest anybody. However, I would say that the level of religious interest of an individual editor, or lack thereof, makes a huge difference. Now, that doesn't mean those people are personally religious or devout or anything of the sort. I'm thinking like Henry Brunwald is a very well-known editor of Time magazine for a very long period of time, later ambassador to Austria, fascinating fellow, who wrote a book about his blindness. He's now deceased. What's the name of that book? Anyway, very interesting. He had macular degeneration. Wrote about that. A man of many parts, fascinated with religion. So all the time Grunwald was running Time magazine, you know that religion stories were going to get a good shape. He was very interested in the field, found it intriguing. As far as I know, didn't have a scintilla of religious faith, or at least he never expressed anything of the sort. It seemed to be a secular Jewish fellow. But very knowledgeable about religion and very interested because he had very Catholic interests. He was interested in everything, classical music and baseball and everything, which made him a great editor. You know, just interested in a lot of stuff. And if you don't have... The biggest challenge is when you have editors who have no interest in religion. If they don't, and you've got a great news story dealing with something in religion... I mean, you can hit them over the head with cinder blocks and so on. It matters not. And this isn't true of celebrity news, sports, business. You know, you could have an editor you're working with who has no interest in economics or hockey or whatever, but they know they've got to have sports coverage, or they got to, you know, cover all the Hollywood stuff and so on. You know, and review the movies. I mean, those things that never discuss. But religion is hard to sell and explain as a topic for treatment if somebody is totally tone deaf in that field. So I had, you know, real difficulty sometimes selling a very good religion story. I could, you know, tell more stories about that. But that's more what I ran into, I would say. And there were always, you know, folks on the staff who were churchgoers, and when they used to stop by and we would chat about this and that, you know. So there were folks on the Time magazine staff in those days who were very active churchgoers, very interested in religious affairs.
And you said religion coverage at Time has a legacy going back all the way to Henry Luce, the founder of the magazine, in the 20s, who had an interest in having good religion coverage.
Yeah, Henry Luce, an interesting guy. His parents were Presbyterian missionaries to China, some of you may know. And he was a lifelong affiliated with the Presbyterian Church himself. I don't know about his own personal theology or anything. But he had a brilliant idea in journalism that when he started Time in 1923, they immediately covered fields that had never been covered in the press, including the press itself. He had a press section covering what's going on. And that was a wild idea at the time. Nobody had ever done that. He had a law section and education, of course. Today, education is very well covered, but not so much back then. And religion was in the very first section of Time in 1923. Newsweek and U.S. News, it took them really decades to catch up with Luce's concept. And even today, Time is the only one of the three news magazines that has a designated religion writer on staff. So the tradition continues, though not easily.
It's a tough time economically for newspapers and news magazines, and religion coverage is often a casualty of cutbacks for the media. Is religion coverage, that when you look at the state of religion coverage, is it worse than in other fields right now for the news media? And if so, why does the news media have such a hard time covering religion?
Yeah, as I've indicated, it tends to be one of those things that are not automatically covered, like city council or... obituaries or business or, you know, that type of a field. And so it always has a bit of a struggle. Although at the moment, we have more members by far in our National Religion Writers Association, which is all general and secular media people. It's not, you know, parochial or church publications. But those of us who work in so-called mainstream media, the membership is double what it was some years ago. So a lot of papers have full-time or part-time religion specialists, and Associated Press when I went there, they doubled the staff. They hired two of us to come in to do religion when one man left for another job. So we doubled the staff, and we actually had three religion writers full-time for a period of a couple of years after 9/11, when Islam worldwide needed some special coverage. And National Public Radio does more with religion than it did a generation ago. CNN hired a religion correspondent a couple of years ago after years of wondering whether they should do that or not. So there are signs of life here and there. Yet I could point to an equal number of situations where coverage has declined or disappeared. And so it's always a mixed picture.
Several
depends on editors' whims, really. They get right down to it.
Several years ago, you went to the Vatican. I believe you were at the Vatican to talk to a cardinal named Joseph Ratzinger, who has now become Pope Benedict. Can you talk about your personal impressions of then Cardinal Ratzinger? What was he like? What was that interview like?
Yeah, that was an interesting occasion. It took months to set that up. The guy who organized that was John Moody, who's now the number two man at the Fox News Channel, and lives in Ridgewood, New Jersey, my hometown. And was my boss at Time Magazine later through a change in assignments. Anyway, in those last years when Time was still doing excellent Vatican coverage, John was the last Roman bureau chief of Time Magazine. He had to close down the bureau when the economics hit full force. It took him months of pulling chains and so on to get that interview. And the deal they finally worked out with Ratzinger was that he would answer questions in writing submitted by us, and then he would grant us an audience of an hour where he would do follow-up questions to the canned or prepared interview. So we went into his office, and it was myself and Greg Burke, who's now also with the Fox News Channel, as their Rome and Mideast correspondent. And so the three of us were there, and Ratzinger was there with one of his aides. The aide was there as a translator, sort of, into English. He, of course, is a native German speaker. And at the time, as you know, he's now the Pope, but back then he was probably assistant Pope. That is, he was head of the doctrinal office and was the most powerful single figure in the Vatican. Well, there are two. He and the Secretary of State, but the Secretary of State is an administrative guy, so he keeps the trains running on time or whatever, and the budget's balanced. Ratzinger was the conceptual or theological brains of the Vatican, advising the Pope, and extremely influential for a very long period of time, and very controversial because he was quite conservative on a lot of issues. Now, what interested me was sort of the cultural game going on here, because Ratzinger had done a lot of interviewing with conservative Catholics. In fact, an entire book had come out with questions and answers from Ratzinger, which caused quite a storm at the time because cardinals didn't do this sort of thing. You know, and he took pot shots at conservatives he didn't like and trends in the wider society that concerned him. And it was very caused a lot of discussion. He had never given, to my knowledge, a sit-down with a secular or general news medium until that day. And what struck me was he was totally comfortable in that situation of talking about, you know, why we have to have theological discipline and we may have to take actions against theologians who, you know, go too far beyond the line, and the challenge of secularism and what he liked and didn't like about Protestants and all kinds of stuff. Very direct and very candid. And particularly interesting to me was he didn't need that translator sitting over here. You know, he is perfectly fluent in English. And you're dealing, obviously, in an interview setting like this. I'm not talking like, you know, pidgin English or the kind of, you know, ordering in the Chinese restaurant kind of a thing. I mean, you're dealing with very complicated theological and cultural questions and events in society and all the rest of it, and very conversant. He is the first Roman pontiff who is fluent in the English language in the last 2,000 years, or however far back the papacy goes. He's also I think it's fair to say the first pope who understands Protestantism, which means he understands what he likes and what he doesn't like about it. He understands liberal Protestantism and conservative Protestantism and their strengths and weaknesses. So he's a very different pope in those ways. And, of course, he's also very different from his predecessor, who was an actor, a showman, a big, larger-than-life personality. Ratzinger is a typical academician. Calm and quiet, kind of your Dallas Willard, very measured and a little soft-spoken and thoughtful, and not a flashy or showy speaker at all. Has a little more of a humble manner. I don't mean that John Paul lacked humility, but just comparing the two, he's a very different figure. But he's more warm and engaging than the popes of the past, who really were Pius XII, it's kind of a very remote figure, didn't mix comfortably with the hoi polloi. So he's not that type at all.
Finally, before we open it up, I have to ask you about your observations about the place of Mormonism in the American religious landscape. Are perceptions of Mormonism changing? What perceptions did you find when you first reported and wrote the book in the late 90s, and have they even changed since?
Yeah, well, there's a lot you can say about Mormonism, obviously, this year, above all. But although a lot of people don't know that Harry Reid is as devout as Mitt Romney, and unlike Romney, he's likely to remain, as he is now, the most powerful Mormon in the history of the United States. Senate Majority Leader, he's on the television news each and every night. He's attempted to derail almost anything of importance that the elected president of the United States has tried to do in the last year or two. Very powerful figure. Romney, if he doesn't get the White House, will be another ex-governor along with dozens of others. So we'll see. But the combination, a little bit of Reed, although people seem to not realize he's a devout Mormon, and a lot of Romney, and then the Salt Lake Olympics, all this stuff is combined to put Mormonism on the map in a way that it hasn't been before, and more of a more national visibility rather than just being limited geographically to the Intermountain West. Now, not all the attention is favorable because some, as a result, particularly the Romney campaign, the hostility of a certain degree of Americans has come to the fore. There's quite a bit of feeling against having a Mormon president. Depending on how the question's asked, it'd be 15, 20, 30% or more would say, well, I'm not sure about it, or I think America is not ready, regardless of what I think, and so on. And much more than the prejudice against, for instance, women or blacks as being president. I think so Romney would have a heavier prejudice weight if he were to get the nomination than either Obama or Clinton running for president, whether or not it surfaces. And the most hostility does not come from the evangelical Protestants that you'll hear about, although that's obviously a factor in voting in South Carolina and so on, but it's from secular writers like Slate, which is the online magazine of the Washington Post Company, and what was the other piece?
John Krakauer's book.
The John Krakauer book, another good example. And I was thinking of articles about specifically, can we afford having a Mormon president? The editor of Slate just said, well, Mormonism is a stupid religion, and anybody who believes it, just believes all this, and, Joseph Smith was a con man, and so therefore anybody who buys this is not qualified to be president. Damon Linker, and I can't remember where Linker wrote this, but he basically said Mormons have this kind of theocracy thing lurking there, and they believe their prophet is God's mouthpiece, and so therefore there's just too much danger involved in having a Mormon president. So, and these are both voices from the political left and the more secular left, who also very much dislike conservative Protestants. Conservative Catholics being active in politics, and And this carries over even more to Mormons, because if anything, they're seen as more devout than the other guys, you know. So this kind of secular hostility has been very noticeable in the last year.
Did you find, when working on your book, that there were a lot of misperceptions or misunderstandings of Mormonism and what Mormons believe that you had to correct or look into?
Yeah, probably the number one is polygamy. The Mormons are saddled with their founder, I guess it'd be fair to say. Joseph Smith advocated polygamy as a divine commandment, and that commandment is still in the Mormon scriptures as of today. But it was set aside by the authorities of the church in 1890. But we had a group of so-called fundamentalist Mormons who continued the original Joseph Smith revelation up to the present. And they are forever in the news, you know. They're up on child rape charges or forced marriage charges or harboring this or going across state lines to do that or whatever. They're just continually in the news, and it's continual sore or irritant for the main body of the Mormon Church, which is now a century and a quarter beyond polygamy. Until 1978, the Mormons were also saddled with a despicable race doctrine. That is, if you had African blood, you were not able to have the Mormon priesthood, which in their understanding is just about every male man and boy. You enter the priesthood around the age of the Jewish bar mitzvah, and that enables you to do almost anything in the church. You can do hardly anything except attend worship services if you do not have the priesthood. Compared, this is another, no women in the priesthood. I'm thinking of the position of men and adolescent boys in Mormonism. So it was a huge disability visited on purely racial reasons by, it is taught, God's only divinely appointed prophets with divine authority on the face of the earth. So it's pretty heavy stuff. That ended in 1978, but that lurks there and makes some people nervous.
Well, let me turn it over to all of you. Topics we covered, topics we didn't cover. I'll give you the first question. Yes.
Yeah, the Episcopal, I mean, in terms of what's going on in the news, the Episcopal split and the parallel split in the Anglican Church of Canada, less dramatic, but similar, is a huge story. It's coming to a head this year, and the reason is this: every 10 years, every Episcopal and Anglican bishop in the world meets in Canterbury, in England, and they get together and issue pronouncements and so on. The last meeting issued a very conservative policy on this issue, a biblical authority and how it relates to sexual morality, and they said very clearly that church cannot countenance same-sex relationships, activities, or marriage, and no clergy, and so on and so forth. Now, the U.S. Episcopal Church has gone in a different and more liberal direction. So the question is, what's to be done about it? The large majority of Anglicans in the world are on the conservative side of this issue. So the churches in Northern Virginia, several prominent churches, have thus affiliated themselves with overseas Anglican jurisdictions because they no longer feel comfortable in the U.S. Episcopal Church, which is in the hands of people with liberal views on all of this. We've never quite had this kind of a situation. We have one way to look at this. Oh, I might say this is why the international aspect is why the Episcopal thing is different from, say, the Presbyterian split. Presbyterians, in a way, are even more split on this issue than Episcopalians. But they don't have this international aspect, because it's a purely American U.S. denomination. So, but these people can say, hey, we're affiliated, we're part of the Anglican Church of Nigeria, or Rwanda, or Southeast Asia is another one involved, or Kenya, Uganda, whatever. So, South America. So, Anglican jurisdictions in good standing, which have established beachheads in the United States of America. As missions to the conservative minority that doesn't agree with the majority position in the U.S., but does agree with the majority position worldwide. And all this is going to be fought out in June, July, and August of this year on a global basis. Now, one thing that interests me is what I would call the rise of liberal fundamentalism in the Episcopal Church. That is, the Episcopalians have been devoted to the idea that you can have a lot of different views, for instance, on sexual morality or the Bible or anything else. But there are two absolutes that remain. The most important absolute is money. Okay, they would say that the conservative guys in Virginia, fine, you can believe what you want. You cannot own this building and this property and this bank account. You know, millions and millions of dollars are at stake in this fight. And the same thing in Southern California. And in a way, the California situation might become more important than the Virginia one. Now, in other words, there is one moral absolute, and that is that the Episcopal Church must keep its hands on all those, that bricks and mortar, all those nice stone buildings, and all those bank accounts, and everything that goes with it, and the cemetery plots, and the whole business, right? A century and more ago, the church underwent another schism. The Reformed Episcopal Church was formed by a Calvinistic, low church wing of the Episcopal Church, went out. No lawsuits. They said, you know, bye-bye. You know, take your. They had a bishop, and they all went off and started a new denomination, and they took their bank accounts and their parishes and their cemeteries, and the church said, "Well, sorry to see you go," and so on. There was no conflict because nobody wanted to sue. But today's Episcopal Church, I believe, because it is on the defensive and is losing members and vitality every year, feels more defensive and has established a church law that gives the majority control over property and assets and so on. Therefore, millions of dollars in mission money is going to be wasted on fruitless litigation and so on. So nobody will win but the lawyers in the end. Then the other absolute is one bishop, one city. This is a canon of the Council of Nicaea of 325 AD, which said, you can't have two competing bishops in the same jurisdiction. Well, therefore, that means you can't have a parish in Virginia that answers to a bishop in Nigeria instead of Richmond, Virginia, right? In other words, you can't have these overlapping jurisdictions. So they're very insistent on honoring the canons of Nicaea. And, of course, the answer for the conservatives is, wow, all of a sudden you guys care about Christian tradition. Well, does Christian tradition teach anything about the Bible and its authority and what the Bible teaches about sexual morality? An extremely ironic and amusing article about that by the primate of the Church of Nigeria, which is the large, in terms of actual worshipers on Sunday morning, the largest Anglican church in the world, not the Church of England. And he had made sport of the liberal Episcopalians on this. Anyway, that's a long answer, but that's basically what's going on and worth watching this year.
And related to that, I guess, would you just talk more about how the national magazines that you're aware of and friends that you have, what are they making of the changing face of global Christianity? That it's not just a European or American, North American kind of religion, which has often been characterized as.
Yeah.
But it's a religion that's truly global, mm-hmm. and just growing by leaps and bounds.
Yeah, as you said, this bears directly on the last question, because the reason, the dynamic here is the power of the third world or developing world or new younger churches having so much influence and being so strong and growing and vital and very conservative on sexual morality. The same dynamic is occurring this year. You'll see this in the United Methodist Church. Any Methodists here, by the way? The very interesting thing is going to happen at the General Conference this year in May, and that is that nothing's going to happen. By which I mean every quadrennial meeting since 1972 has wrestled with the gay issue. this is a long-running issue for the church. And every 4 years, this thing comes up. And I think this year is going to end that. Well, there'll probably be liberal motions on the floor, but it's not going to go anywhere. Excuse me. And one reason is that the American Methodist, United Methodist Church, has just taken in the church of, I believe it's Sierra Leone. So we have 1 million Africans who will have voting delegates represented at this year's UMC conference. So, you know, this is a church with 8 million members. So, I mean, just look at the numbers, you know. They're going to lurch to a more conservative voting. And they've already held to a conservative view on the sexual issue consistently over this period of time. And Philip Jenkins' book on... he's done two books on the developing world and the style of Christianity there and the power of it. He's a professor of history at Penn State University and a member of the Episcopal Church, by the way. And he has really looked at this and I think brought it together in a very nice scholarly fashion that's gotten a lot of attention. Those books by Jenkins are well worth reading. The first is just kind of the move to the South and documenting. And then the second one is how preaching and the life of the church is so different in a developing situation where the government is corrupt and the economy is unstable and you cannot really get a good education and you cannot build a decent career and people are dying in large numbers and medical services are not available. And what he says is, this is the New Testament church. This is what it was like to be a Christian in AD 50. These people live and breathe the New Testament in ways that affluent Americans simply cannot understand. And this does, among other things, carry into the sexual realm.
That book was excerpted as a cover story in the Atlantic Monthly about 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And but do you think the news media as a whole, sort of the establishment news media, got the message, read that piece, and realizes that the center of Christianity has moved to the global south?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot's been written about it, but I think American media tend to be parochial, even after 9/11.
Yeah.
Very shockingly few news organizations have many foreign correspondents, and they've really pulled back a lot, even though, you know, we're caught economically and politically and militarily. We're just engaged in all kinds of stuff overseas. So, pardon me, this is a period when Americans should be learning more and more about the big wide world, but it seems to be only a minority that really are making an effort to be aware of things there. So, yeah, I think that the media have probably tossed out stories on this, but haven't really given a lot of attention, and they don't have the resources to do on-scene coverage. I did mention the AP, which is terrific. For several years, we had a foreign-based, full-time religion writer covering Africa, a little bit of South America, and a lot of Islam in the Mideast, and be able to put out a lot of stories. They still do, the Wire still does that with bureaus, and they do a fair amount of coverage, though we don't have that specialist at the moment.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts. I was interested in your exploration of the marginalization of religion writers in journalism and how that might interface with the rise of religious studies programs across the nation's academic institutions. Of course, it's in tandem with women's studies and gender studies and cultural studies and urban and race and all these other studies. Mm-hmm. But how those two things might work together, conflict or be ironic in that those trends.
Yeah, the big picture is in general media, if you're looking back, take a baseline of 1950 and up to the present, over those decades, generally speaking, there's been more and more religion coverage and the quality has gone up. But year to year, it does vary. And in each individual, let's say, metropolitan newspaper, it may go up and down based on the editor's whims or the skills of the staff or, you know, other things like that. So generally, there's been more and better religion coverage in the same decades in which there's been more scholarship and more departments of religion and secular campuses and so on. So the two do seem to go together. And I mentioned in my talk this morning, if you need any reminder that religion is a powerful force in the USA, just, you know, look at this presidential campaign that's going on. And even the Democrats are in on the game now, you know. I mean, there's a big piety outbreak among Democrats wishing to be president. And you see some of the same state and local level on the Democratic Party. So there's an attempt to have a two-party religious system as well as politically, in a sense. And again, this is as hard as some media people may try to pretend that religion is not a vital force in the U.S. culture, at least. They're just hit with continual reminders that it's there. You know, it may be a horrible thing, like the Catholic molesting scandal, which got huge coverage. But, you know, it was just a reminder of its negative aspects as well as positive.
I was wondering who you might, in your view, which print media outlets might be the most influential right now?
Oh, well, the New York Times is without competition at the moment in influence, and the Associated Press. But with two very different audiences. The New York Times is important because opinion leaders and policymakers in Washington, D.C., and the media capitals in Los Angeles and New York follow it very closely and are heavily influenced by their news agenda and also by the way they shape particular themes and stories. The Associated Press is important because it's by far the biggest, which means they have people everywhere. And generally, the typical middle-sized newspaper and radio and television network and station and so on, they all, even though they're presenting stuff as sort of the news, what they're presenting is Associated Press material. AP is totally different from the New York Times in its ethos. I was 8 years with the AP, and I could not tell you honestly what the political leanings or even winks and hints would be of anybody that I worked with for 8 years. The ethos there is if you have any opinions, you keep them to home. I mean, you know, talk to your wife. Nobody ever says this, but the Wire is dedicated as best as it can to total nonpartisan, balanced, fair coverage and trying to be as objective as humanly possible, nonpartisan, and so on. As a result, what I'm saying is it even seeps into the city room, you know, where I suspect, you know, the political leanings of people that I worked with, but I could never prove it by anything anybody ever said or even some little sly remark and so on. It's very interesting. But I would say that the New York Times has become much more obvious as an advocate of liberal political and cultural, moral, and so on. It's almost the paper of record for the politically correct movement and so on. And it does not have any competition in the sense of a daily news vehicle which has a different point of view. You can find the conservative equivalent by certain, you know, trolling the internet or the Weekly Standard or publications of that sort. But in terms of a full-service, heavily staffed, long-standing, respected daily news source, the New York Times does not have any competition, which I think is a bad thing for the country, and it's also a bad thing for the New York Times.
Rupert Murdoch will do his best to change that, right?
With the Wall Street Journal. He wants the Wall Street Journal to be, but the Journal is saddled with being a business paper, so they'll never have the room to cover general news the way the New York Times does, unless they produce a satellite daily, which is a general interest periodical, but I wouldn't predict that.
Do you think the Times' decrease in circulation recently is a result of their far left political leanings, or that there are more news outlets available to the population at large?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I don't think it hasn't. Probably. No, I don't think it has affected the Times adversely, though some conservatives might argue that. But they're hit like every other newspaper with the draining away of advertising revenues to new media. That's the big problem. So they're suffering exactly what the, let's say, moderate Chicago Tribune and the slightly liberal Los Angeles Times and the fairly conservative Oklahoma Daily Oklahoman in Oklahoma City. And everybody is hit with this. It's a serious problem because these are the people who cover the business of government and the business in the United States of America. And newspapers go down. I don't see a natural way to replace them with anything else, you know. Most of the stuff on the Internet is borrowed from newspapers. It's not original reporting. And a lot of it is inaccurate, misleading, amateurish, or just opinion. You know, some guy sounding off, he may or may not know what he's talking about. So it's a tough situation developing, I think.
George.
Could you comment on the role of the religious right in the 2008 campaign? Both the Protestant and the Catholic, it doesn't seem that they have a candidate that they can coalesce around as easily as in the past.
Yeah, very interesting. This is going to be, already is and will be, one of the most interesting elections religiously we face. I mean, we have strong religious figures in the mix, like Huckabee and Romney particularly, but also Obama. And even in her own way, Hillary Clinton is a classic social gospel Methodist who is spotty, but still is a church attender. You know, she does attend church sometimes and was fairly regular when she was First Lady. So, you know, it's all very, very fascinating. The trouble with the so-called religious right, a lot of the coverage forgets you're talking about Catholics and Jews as well as Protestants. It's always, oh, it's Protestants and evangelicals, and they're doing this, they're doing that. They forget the other guys. And actually, Mormons, of course, are also part of the religious right as a cultural phenomenon. Okay, so that there's two directions. One is to overestimate their importance. You see a lot of books in the last 2 years about, oh, we're this far from theocracy, these guys are going to take over, and they want to impose right-wing evangelicalism on the American Republic and eliminate the Constitution. And I have about 20 or 30 books in my basement right now that basically say the same thing. They're all the same book, just from different authors. And then you have the other thing, oh, the religious right is dead, you know, it's passé, and Pat Robertson is, you know, fading in influence. Jerry Falwell died, and Jim Kennedy, and now we're in a new era. And nobody's listening to the leadership anymore, and so it's all going down the drain. Well, both of those are not the case. You're absolutely right. They don't have a candidate this year, so that has affected the politics greatly. But they are a permanent minority faction in the Republican coalition. And you can see them as the black Republicans. That is, they are the most loyal faction in the Republican coalition, the way blacks are the most loyal in the Democratic coalition. So I was talking with Barb Steen here about Washington, D.C., and the way in which Hillary and Bill Clinton have played on racial feelings in order to grab the presidential nomination right in this period of weeks. A fascinating story. Now, you might think this would turn off black America and they would be very resentful, and there is a lot of that feeling. Nevertheless, the black vote will turn out heavily and loyally for the Democratic nominee if it's Hillary Clinton in the fall. And whether or not Obama is on the ticket, even if they have a white vice president on the ticket, they can count on the black vote and the Jewish vote, just as Republicans can count generally on the conservative Protestant, conservative Catholic and Orthodox Jewish and Mormon vote. That's a solid part of the Republican thing. And they're all, even if, say, McCain gets a nomination, they kind of don't like him in some ways, but they'll turn out and vote for him even though they don't have a natural candidate. The thing to watch is whether the Democrats eventually really do get religion. You know, if they really do become the way the Democratic Party was in the era of Roosevelt, Truman, and Kennedy, when there really was no religious difference to speak of between the two major parties. And the factions were lined up differently, but both of them were fairly respectful and, you know, secular kind of folks were not so prominent. If you're interested in this, Jeffrey Lehman, spelled G-E-O-F-F-R-E-I-Y, political scientist at the University of Maryland, wrote a whole book on how basically, one of his major themes was how secularized the Democratic Party became beginning in 1972, and how the religious right followed that. This is the opposite of the normal scenario. And he has data including the religious sentiments of National Party convention delegates. Fascinating stuff. So I'm sorry I cannot remember the name, the title of the book, but if you go on Amazon.com and put up G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, Lehman, you'll find that book, and you might enjoy perusing it.
One last question?
Yes. I'm kind of curious, of all the articles that you wrote on religion, which was, say, the most personally satisfying for yourself, or maybe the most influential in terms of things that happened as a result?
Yeah, I couldn't point to one article, but I'll tell you one that I was happy with that was a horror story. Okay, it might interest you, and it tells you the kind of stuff you're into. A very idiosyncratic scholar named James Tabor at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte called me up one day. He had looked at some of these hidden Dead Sea Scrolls that scholars were sitting on and never got around to translating, and everybody's mad about it. Well, he got a look at some of the new stuff coming out in the early 90s, and he called me up one day, and he said, there is a scroll 100 years before the time of Christ which says the definition of the coming Messiah will be, and he proceeded to read this thing to me, and it was the same passage of what Jesus tells John's disciples to go back and tell them, you know, the poor will have the gospel preached to them, the dead will be risen. It's like the job definition of the Messiah, which Jesus claimed for himself to John the Baptist 100 years before in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Great story, right? Man. Okay. It took 6 months of, bloodletting and discouraging everything else to get that story into the magazine. The editors just didn't see why anybody would care two hoots about something like that. Who cares, right? Then what happened during a summer vacation, my normal editor, who had been, you know, working for months to try to get this thing in, and probably everybody was sick of it by now, Charlie Alexander was assigned that 1 week to the religion section. He was the science guy, science editor. So he was in there, you know, pushing medical advances and all this kind of a thing. And I mentioned this to Charlie. I have no idea if Charlie is religious at all. He went nuts for that story. Well, this is fantastic, he said. My goodness, you know. And he went in and he browbeat the editors of the magazine into getting that thing into a Time that week. 2-page story. But it was a very good story. And fortunately, the newsman's worst nightmare, somebody else will get the story. For 6 months, I was sitting there thinking somebody else was going to get the story. Nobody ever got it. And the story, to my pleasure, was this, when the first major display of actual literal Dead Sea Scrolls was put on by the Library of Congress. That story from Time magazine was posted next to the actual scroll that was presented in the magazine. So that was very satisfying, but it also typified the difficulties in writing about religion for secular editors.
When was that published?
I'm thinking 93, 94, somewhere in early 90s.
Was that scroll the Book of Isaiah? That's what it sounds like.
No, it was not a scriptural. It was a non-scriptural writing in the Qumran community talking about the Messiah that they were looking for. So what it tells you is that anticipation of exactly what Jesus presented himself as was a faction within Judaism anticipating the coming Messiah a century before. And Jesus, you can say, was saying, you know that one ad in the newspaper? You know, moi.
Would you join me in thanking Richard Austin?
Communion, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
Don't forget your...
Oh, okay.